Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Forsake your sins. Don't see R-rated movies. And go no more after the lust of your eyes. For the mind through which this filth passes is never the same afterwards.
You're not going to prevent people from editing movies, whether they do it in their basement or whether they do it in Canada. You're not going to stop people from editing movies.
I bless you with the increased discernment to judge between Christ and Antichrist.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Rob St. Mary, and of course, joining me, Mr. Mike White.
Put that coffee down.
That's right. This week, we're talking about how I think Glengarry Glen Ross would be a 10-minute short if the folks got their hands on it, what we're talking about. This week, we're talking about Clean Flicks, the 2009 documentary from Andrew James and Joshua Legare. The film tells the tale of Clean Flicks, a business based in Utah that would sterilize Hollywood films. The mission, to remove those nasty words, graphic violence, nudity, sexual references, basically all the good stuff that, of course, us Projection Booth fans and co-hosts alike really seem to enjoy. Clean Flicks, a documentary, tells the tale of the rise and fall of the Clean Flicks company, its brethren, its dozens of spin-off companies that tried to fight the good fight to keep R-rated films out of the hands of good, God-fearing Mormon people, mostly. So, Mike, what did you think about Clean Flicks?
I really enjoyed it. It was right in my sweet spot as far as looking at crazy Christians and movies. So it kind of hit all the things for me. You know, it was kind of like a less scary version of Jesus Camp mixed with a little bit of this film is not yet rated. So it was right there.
I've always found the idea of film censorship very interesting. I mean, as far back as we can go into the silent period, I mean, things like Birth of a Nation or even before that, and then forward, obviously we've talked about movies such as Deep Red on the Projection Booth and how that thing was cut up based on where you saw it and what country and everything, and just the idea of distributors cutting films for particular reasons, either be for pacing or we don't want a two-hour film, we want an hour and 40-minute film, we can get more behinds and seats in the theaters. And with this one, I have to say that it really, I think this one bothers me more than the idea of a distributor or a film studio cutting a film.
It reminded me a lot of like fan editing when I was watching this. You know, fan editing goes in and takes things that have been cut out or will remove things and kind of re-spin them. I've actually seen one version of like War of the Worlds where they went in and kind of put in things from Deep Impact and just trying to make it a better story. So it's kind of like taking the story, taking the film out of the hands of the people that put it out and putting it into other people's hands. Now, when it comes to fan editing, I can see that as being very much a way of trying to make things better. Usually it's people that are trying to improve things or try to preserve things. But then there are some people where it's like, oh no, I know this art better than the people that put it out, so I'm going to give it my own flavor. Even then, it's like, okay, you know, at least the original is still out there. At least it's still available for me. But when it comes to Clean Flicks, it's like, yeah, no, you shouldn't be watching the original. You should only watch the version that we are providing to you. And that's the one that's free of all of these nasty things. And not even all the nasty things, the things that one particular person or, you know, maybe a group of a smaller group of editors find objectionable. And that's the one that, yeah, it really, it left a bad taste in my mouth.
the documentary starts with one of the elders of the church back in the 1980s talking about how if you let unclean ideas or things that are, you know, quote unquote offensive or violent or sexual or whatever into you in some way, if you observe them or you watch them, that this will somehow like taint you. This will make you, you know, it'll move you away from God. So therefore you shouldn't do that. And what I find kind of interesting about this whole idea is there are several times where I can agree with the Mormons here. And there are several times, most of the time, I don't. And the one I'll tell you why I agree, one section where I agree with the Mormons is at one point they're like, look, why doesn't the Hollywood studios just sell us the airplane edits? Why don't they sell us the free TV edits? And then we'll watch those because those won't have the violence, those won't have the language and all the things that they're upset about. Now, I can agree with them on that. I'm like, if they want to sell, you know, the TV edit of the film, great, because then at least that way the people who are creating the film in some way, they have control over it. So, and if they don't want to make that edit, they can Alan Smithy it all day long. They can take their name off it if they want to, which has been the case with, as you know, with studios hacking films to bits. And then, you know, I think David Lynch, what did he take his name off Dune, going back to Dune at one point? I think maybe Terry Gilliam took his name off of the TV edit of Brazil. So there's at least room for the studio in there to do that kind of thing. The thing that I find kind of odd is that it seems like they want to have, they want to be part of the culture and not part of the culture at the same time. And what I mean by that is that when we talk about religious people or people of faith, fine, I don't have a problem with you wanting to be a person of faith. That's wonderful. That's your thing. And the thing is that there's often this pull between I'm of the world and I'm not of the world. I've removed myself from that because I'm living in this other place. But the thing is it seems like they want to also exist within the mainstream culture at the same time. And now within Mormonism, this really isn't such a new idea. And where I originally sort of saw this idea within Mormonism originally actually goes back to the late 1800s. It goes back before movies were even created. They didn't bring this up in clean flicks. But I saw this on the Criterion of Carnival of Souls. And on there, there's a documentary or a photo slideshow that talks about the Salt Air Pavilion in Utah. It was built in 1893. And eventually this place would become the biggest dance hall in America. It was supposed to be sort of the Coney Island of the West. It was built by the Mormon Church and also with a railroad company. And to me, it sort of represents this idea that they want to have the ability to sing and dance and do all the things that all the mainstream people are doing, but yet they still want to control it in the same way. And it's like you can't really have it both ways. You either have to accept what's out there or you have to turn away from it. It's one or the other. You can't have both. And several of the comments that you hear from some of the people that are going to the video stores to rent stuff, to me, are laughable and at the same time offensive at the same time, but they don't realize they're offensive. And what I mean by this is I remember there was one guy who's in the documentary saying that, last week I watched all these gangster movies. I watched The Godfather and Goodfellas and all this stuff. And I was thinking to myself, I'm like, what are they, like 10-minute shorts? Like, how could you edit Goodfellas down so that there was no objectionable material and still have a coherent story?
Sex and Violence, you know, is the song that they play through the beginning and end of this film, the old exploited song. And it's like, really, it should just be sex, because so much of what is found objectionable is the sexual part of it. But the violence, you know, they do show some examples, and that is fascinating to actually see side-by-side comparisons of what has been taken out in the films that we're talking about versus, you know, what was originally there. And most of the time, I mean, there's a couple, like, you know, gun to the head in The Matrix and that kind of stuff, but still, like, shooting people, not necessarily that big of a deal, as long as it's not too ultra-violent, as it were. But the sex, you got to get rid of the sex. You got to get rid of even references to sex, like that line from The Big Lebowski where, you know, I'll suck your cock for $1,000. It's like, that's gone. The reference to that is gone. And it's like, but yet, you know, I'm sure, references to human toes and stuff, absolutely fine, you know, getting those for a couple hundred dollars or whatever. And it's just like, wow, it makes no sense. It reminds me of when I was working at the movie theater way back when, and parents would come in and they'd start asking, like, you know, oh, is there a lot of sex in this movie? Is there nudity? And it's like, well, there might be a bare breast or something. Oh, well, I don't know. You know, how about a ticket for this other film? It's like, well, that film is really super violent, you know. Maybe you shouldn't let your kids see this. You know, you should be okay with letting them see a boob. No, no, no. Give me the ticket for the violent movie. There's no way my kids are seeing a naked body.
Yeah. And the whole thing is that there's several other clips, one of which that I find just ridiculous is two of them that the scene is edited in two different movies. One is The Weatherman. There's a clip from The Weatherman. And the other is Kindergarten Cop, in which it's not even a sexual reference. It's just a... You know the scene I'm talking about, where the little girl is going to go to the bathroom, and then the kid gets up and then just states scientifically what the names of the parts are.
Boys have a penis, girls have a vagina.
That had to go. We couldn't even have scientific names of body parts, because that might give you a sexual thought. The other thing I also found really disturbing in here, and I'm sure they didn't think that it was disturbing saying so, was someone complained about the nudity in Schindler's List. And I just wanted to, like if this person was next to me, I would have strangled them, because this is the same complaint. This was probably 10 years ago. I don't know if you remember this. I think it was NBC played Schindler's List in its entirety with no commercials. It was just, they were going to play it. It was some sort of thing related to like Holocaust Memorial or something like that. The one thing I found ironic was it was sponsored by Ford, but whatever. It was completely commercial free. It was sponsored by Ford. And knowing Henry Ford is an anti-Semite, I said, you know, he's probably rolling over in his grave right now. But anyway, they got complaints. The FCC and NBC got complaints because of the nudity in Schindler's List. And I'm like, and where is the nudity in Schindler's List? It's in the frickin' gas chambers. I'm like, that is not erotic. That is not sexual. If you find naked people in the gas chambers in a Holocaust movie sexual, then you have a real fucking problem, man. You got a severe problem and you need to go to therapy, because that is just disturbing that you would equate that nudity to eroticism or to sexuality, and it's not.
Watching this film the second or third time that I watched it, I did start to really kind of see that point that you're talking about, as far as why aren't the TV versions or the airplane versions available. And that is true. I mean, when I pick up so many movies these days, it's like, you know, you put in the DVD and the first thing that comes up is, do you want to see the theatrical version or the unrated version? And it's like, well, of course I'm going to see the unrated version, because it's like, there's probably more stuff to it. You know, let's see what was there. Though there are some movies that I prefer the theatrical version to the director's cut or whatever. You know, I'm thinking of like Chronicles of Riddick, where it's just like, yeah, I really kind of prefer the version I saw originally to this. But yeah, it would be nice if it was like, or the tame version was also available. Yeah, maybe the filmmaker can do that. Maybe they can hire an intern to go ahead and start cutting it up or whatever it is. Yeah, maybe it should be available to people. But at the same time, it's like, also, this is what I've done. You know, there's such a fight for the director's cut, you know, such a fight for that final cut from the director, that I would really hate to see that kind of usurped and have that readily available for people to say, no, no, this is the right version, is this cleaned up version.
And I think the thing is that, hate to say it, but film in America is seen more as entertainment. It's not seen as art as much as maybe in Europe. And this is the problem that I also see with some of the opinions of the people who are interviewed or doing these things within the documentary. They don't seem to understand. It would be like if we went into an art museum, like if we asked them, we said, look, let's go in the art museum. Here's a Rubens, naked woman. Should we paint it? Should we put like a dress on her? Should we do that to, you know, the Botticelli, the Venus on the Half Shell? Would that be okay? Now, I'm sure within the context, we would say, well, no, you don't want to do that to a 300-year-old painting. But really, to me, there's no difference between you're going to sit here and hack apart someone's vision of a film versus you're going to paint over, you know, the Venus on the Half Shell. No, it's still censorship. It's still changing in some way the vision that the artist had. And, you know, the only way that I think you can really get around this would be if, in the case of, let's go back to what we talked about on the VHS show, where your old employer, Blockbuster, wouldn't carry certain things, or they would carry them, but they would only carry R-rated versions, such as Requiem for a Dream. They would not carry the unrated version of that. It had to be an R-rated version of that. Or, for the example I was thinking of as I was watching the film, was I remember in high school when In Utero came out, the Nirvana album. In order to get that into Walmart, into Kmart, they had to fuzz out the back, which was all just anatomical mannequins and drawings of, you know, various organs and things like that, sexual organs. And then they had to change the lyrics from "rape me" to "waif me." When asked why they decided to do this, Kurt Cobain said that the band decided that a lot of kids like them, when they were growing up, their only way to get music was to buy it at the big store because that's all they had in their small town. So they felt between getting a slightly censored version of the album or no album at all, they felt that it was better just to give them a slightly censored version of the album, and then maybe in time they would be able to find a place where they could actually get the whole thing. I don't know if I would make that same ruling if it was me that had to make that decision. I might just say, well, it's take it or leave it. But at least the artist was involved in that decision. Within the Clean Flicks effort, no artist is involved because the film studio says, here's the movie, put it out. And then these guys go, well, that's all great and all, but we're going to edit them. And then the studios told them, well, you can't do that because you're violating our rights.
Well, it's crazy, too, the efforts that are made to change some of these things. I mean, I guess going again back to our VHS episode, we talked about, you know, the two tape Titanic so much, and just all of the different ways, like when they use Titanic as their example, of either cutting around or actually going so far as to put clothes back on, computer generated clothes onto, you know, our heroine in that film. It's just like, what? Is it really that bad that you're seeing Rose's boobs? But apparently it is. It's like they go through so many things, such great lengths to remove that nudity in there. It's just like, oh my God, you know, the technology that you're using to do this is nuts.
It's just quite amazing. And to be honest, I had to laugh that this whole thing was started in Utah in 2000 because of Titanic. That was the first film. They were like, we need to cut down Titanic. And then from there, they just kind of went, they went on and on and on. I like the discussion around, okay, well, there's certain films that you just can't cut. Like, in terms of content, you can't do anything with them. And I loved how they said Brokeback Mountain, Sin City. They said that thing, there's no way to do it. And the third one, which I've always contended is a fucking horrible movie, it's a horrible mainstream film, is Pretty Woman. and I find Pretty Woman horrible for other philosophical reasons. But it's just, I just love that they pulled that one out and said, yeah, we can't do anything with that one.
Runaway Bride, no problem.
No problem.
Pretty Woman, can't do it. You know, I would have liked to have cut down Titanic too, but just for a different reason, just because it was so freaking long.
Yeah, and there's certain things. I mean, when we talk about the various edits, like the really bad edits, like just jumpy things that make no sense, like the Lebowski clip that makes no sense. The one that I thought was pretty amazing was actually Saving Private Ryan, where there's this argument with the different soldiers and they're cutting it. And you don't really hear too many jumps. It seems to play pretty much the same. There's nothing that's really missing. So I was like, well, that's pretty masterful, because the whole thing is, too, you have to realize, too, with these edits, is that they're not dealing with raw. They're not dealing with raw, you know, takes. They're dealing with a locked print, you know, video, obviously, and then going in and trying to make it work. So you have things like score or sound or if it's echoey or something like that. I mean, that stuff can be hard to cut around, you know, to go back and try to tighten a locked print versus if these people were originally given all the raw materials and then told to go ahead and cut their own version.
And at least with, you know, some of the TV edits that they do, they've got, you know, voice talent there when it comes to some of the swearing and stuff. I mean, I remember, you know, like the Blues Brothers. I think they brought in Jim Belushi to record some of his brother's lines as clean versions of those, which were horrible. You know, listening to some of those things in the Blues Brothers, and you're just like, really? Like, they're doing the whole thing about being up the creek without a paddle and stuff, and just all of the shits and fucks and all this kind of stuff that they had to go over just made the whole transaction between the, you know, the characters just made no sense, just none whatsoever. It was like, what is going on? Or like, my favorite TV edit, I think, is The Breakfast Club, when they horribly redubbed the line of "eat my shorts," which I apparently is a very bad thing to say. I didn't realize that, but "eat my socks" is fine. So just the whole thing where like, it's like, "eat my socks." It's like, what did you say? I said, "eat my," and then this horrible voice will come in and be like, "socks." It's like, what?
My favorite of all time, and this is on one of the versions of the Scarface DVD, is there's an explanation from the producer about, well, you know, they wanted to do TV version. And I said, well, how can you do it? You know, because there's so much of all this. He goes, because let's just be creative, you know. And they put together comparisons. It's a good 10-minute clip where they put together these back-to-back comparisons where there's the scene in the beginning. I love this one. The scene in the beginning with Tony, and he's trying to be refugee, you know, and he's being interviewed and all that. And he's got the scar on his face, and it's like,
where'd you get the beauty scar, tough guy? Eating pussy?
And then the TV edit is,
where'd you get that beauty scar, tough guy? Eating pineapple?
And then the best one is where they're driving around and he's like,
"you sound like a great big pussy just waiting to get fucked."
And the voiceover is,
"you sound like a great big chicken just waiting to be plucked."
It's so good. If you haven't seen that whole like back and forth comparison on Scarface, it's just a textbook lesson in how they try to take something that you really can't edit, and when they do it, it becomes just hilarious. It's just ridiculous and obnoxious at the same time.
Well, yeah, like I actually watched the TV version of Snakes on a Plane just so I could hear how they were going to handle the
"I have had it with these motherfucking snakes on this motherfucking plane."
You know, and it was like,
"I have had it with these monkey fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday plane."
Oh man. But the thing that was really interesting in the documentary in Clean Flicks is that one of the owners of the store said that the worst rating that the film has, so if it's like an NC-17 or possibly even like Flirting with X, and they edit that, they said the sales are even higher. People are attracted to this, but at the same time, they're repulsed by it. It's sort of like they want to go to it, but they can't. And then they get this sort of facsimile version of it, and they're still really, really interested. Like, they still really, really want it. And I just found it interesting that there was more money to be made on edits of things that are just total implication. That to me, this documentary is all about implication. It's not about reality. It's not about the real thing. It's about implied. And that somehow just the implication of it is enough to just really like drive people crazy. Like, ooh, you know, that's really hot. I like that because, you know, I get to see the ankle as opposed to the, you know, the upper thigh. It's like, ooh, just show me the ankle. That's enough.
Yeah, like the guy talking about how they used to put covers over table legs, you know, because it might excite people.
Yeah. And to me, ultimately, what this all comes down to, the idea of one group going, we're going to edit this stuff and you don't need this, you know, language and all garbage. And they use all this term and stuff like that, is to me, it's about making the world safe for them. To me, it's about people who need to see the world reflected back at them. Because if they don't see the world reflected back at them, if they don't fill the world full of mirrors, it makes it very uncomfortable for them as someone who's a believer to go out into the world and be strong enough in their faith. Like, my opinion's always been is that if you hold a belief in something, it doesn't matter what your belief is, you should be able to go out into the world and not really care if anyone thinks you're crazy or doesn't like your ideas or not.
Yeah, you need to be strong about it.
Yeah. And to me, this is the easy way out. This is the cheat way. This is the cheap way to go, you know what? I would feel better about the world around me if everything around me reflected right back at me exactly how I feel, because then that way I don't have to think about anything.
I'm not surprised that Utah seems to be this so like insular place where it's just like it's so many of the same kind of faces and the same beliefs. And it's like this big echo chamber for them. And when these things come in that are unsafe, does seem to be the natural thing for them to make them safe rather than just avoid them. Because you're right. It seems like the smart thing would just be like, okay, if this is bad, then I'll avoid it. But no, it's like they want their cake and they want to eat it too.
Yeah. And because they want their cake and eat it too, they do end up in a little bit of trouble. And one guy in particular, and we don't want to ruin the surprise, I should say, Daniel Thompson, one of the owners of several of the stores, ends up on an adventure that he maybe came about because of these kind of things, these sort of repressive and suppressive ideas.
Yeah, I watched the DVD of this recently, and there's some extra scenes in there with Daniel, and it comes to light in the extra scenes that, you know, Daniel, he actually used to play Dungeons and Dragons, so he's been on the outs with church for a long time. He was, you know, kind of a born rebel when it comes to this stuff.
Of course, it's the outside world that is corrupted people. It is not the internal life, you know. It's see, I find it so easy. I mean, maybe this is just because me, you know, both of us, the two of us, are creative people. We've created things, you know, be it film or writing or, you know, being in the media, things like that, where it's so easy to just blame this thing than it is to look at your own, you know, way of being and in your own structure. It's easier to go, you know what, that Judas Priest album made, you know, the kids blow their head off. No, it just there's more going on than you listening to Ozzy Osbourne in 1983. I mean, believe it. I mean, there's more going on, because if that was the case, then there would be millions of people doing this because millions of people have seen these things.
Okay, we're going to take a break and play back an interview we did with Josh Legari and Andrew James, the co-directors of Clean Flicks.
Hey, it's Rob St. Mary from the Projection Booth, and I want to tell you about a humble guy you might have heard of before. It's my podcast partner. His name's Mike White, and he's got a new book out. It's called Cinema Detours, and I just want to tell you that the guy is so humble that he won't even talk about it on the show. He won't even ask you to go to our website, projection-booth.com, or go over to amazon.com and pick up either the paper version or, you know, the ones and zeros, the digital for your Kindle. He won't ask you to do that. That's how humble he is, but I think you need to do it. You want to know why? Because it's a great read, and especially with the movies that you've seen before, it's kind of like chatting with an old friend and having a good laugh. And as for the movies that you haven't seen, well, I got to throw a beat down on Mr. White, because he's now expanded my list probably another 100 films that I need to see. It's Cinema Detours. You can get it at Amazon.com, either in paper form or for your Kindle. And of course, you can always get more information about this book and the Projection Booth podcast at projection-booth.com. It's Cinema Detours.
This is Adam Spiegelman from the cult movie podcast Proudly Resents, and you listen to my favorite movie podcast, The Projection Booth. I know, it's messed up, right?
You know, I was looking for a little excitement, but I was worried about privacy. And then I found out about Vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women, and men, and couples. They have helpful suggestions and information on how to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has never played around with your privacy. While other .coms make their money by selling your information, Vibrators.com never has and never will. And when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order. That's Vibrators.com. Get a little excitement in your life.
My name is Andrew James. I make documentaries. I'm based in Salt Lake City right now, and Clean Flicks was my first feature doc that I worked on with Josh, and now I'm working on a new film called Street Fighting Man, which is set in Detroit. And we're finishing up the editing on that right now. And I also do some other stuff, commercial work, some shorts here and there, but mostly Street Fighting Man's been taking up pretty much all my time for the past 3 years. It kind of jumped right into that as Clean Flicks was winding down. And
My name is Joshua Legary, and I also make documentaries, and for all intents and purposes, Clean Flicks was also my first feature doc. I'd done a few other things before that, but nothing that really I made a big move to kind of get out and try to market and get out to festivals in a big way. Since Clean Flicks premiered in 2009 at the Toronto Film Festival, just at the end of 2009, I started work on a documentary called Skeleton Picnic. There are new developments in the story, and we're kind of seeking more funding to finish that film. I also shot and completed another documentary about suicide in Native communities in Alaska, which we just wrapped filming in December, and that's being edited right now. And working on another project, so just keeping busy. Mostly just doing nonfiction stuff. I've pitched a few reality shows, and we had one picked up by the National Geographic Channel, and pitching another one right now. But it's basically just the lowly life of documentary filmmaker.
How did you guys get together? When did you first meet, and what were the circumstances?
We had a mutual friend named Xavier, who ended up sort of doing some producing on the film with us. You know, Josh and I actually didn't really know each other. Xavier had, I guess, been speaking to Josh, and there was a conversation, I think, Josh, about maybe doing a documentary about Clean Flicks. And then and then Xavier was like, "Hey, Andrew, like, we should do a doc about Clean Flicks." And I was like, "Sounds cool." And nothing could have prepared me for what actually happened, what the film became. I wasn't really sure what was going to come of it, but Xavier introduced us, and we sat down for lunch and just decided to do it. And then just started making film like the next day almost. Shooting and just kind of away we went. It was pretty crazy, really, to think about it.
I'd worked on another documentary that took place in Utah Valley, and Clean Flicks kind of came up during the course of shooting that film. And I thought, man, that would be a great idea for a feature length documentary. And Xavier actually worked at a video store at the time, and I would go in there and we would talk, and he'd always be telling me about his filmmaker friend Andrew and how we should meet, and they were working on a fictional project at the time, and then I saw this film was not yet rated, and when I saw that, I thought, man, we could really do something great about Clean Flicks. And that's when I went and talked to Xavier, like, we should seriously buckle down to this. And he's like, yeah, you've got to meet Andrew, we've been talking about it too. So it kind of just fell into our laps. And honestly, on our first day of production, we met Robert Perry, we met Daniel Thompson, who ended up being, our two main characters, for all intents and purposes. So we kind of just hit the ground running and got to know each other while we were making the movie.
So was it Wrestling with God that kind of was the precursor for this?
That was a short film that Andrew directed we worked on Clean Flicks for almost 3 years. And so it was kind of during that time Andrew made that film. It was Una Vida Mejor was the one that he was working on at the time before we met.
Had you guys had much experience with Mormonism and Utah and this whole kind of subculture beforehand?
Yes.
We were both living there, and we were both raised in the Mormon church. So we had a lot of experience with it. I think Andrew and I had very different experiences growing up in the Mormon church. And I think and also even with Clean Flicks as well, that was for me, that was something that I had never experienced and I thought was kind of strange. I had never seen a Clean Flicks edited movie until we actually started working on the project. So that's kind of where I was coming from on it. But I was, I kind of took the side of, being kind of pro art and pro filmmaker. And that was where I was coming from. And I think my personal opinions kind of evolved as we worked on the project.
I actually graduated from BYU, where we do, a fair amount of shooting, or there's a fair amount of footage in the film we shot on BYU campus. And when I was there at school, it was Clean Flicks is all the rage, or I should say just edited films in general, and people were really excited about it. And it was a thing where kids wouldn't watch the R-rated versions. They would go on the weekends to Clean Flicks, get the clean versions, and everybody would sit down to watch The Matrix, and they're all excited because they didn't feel guilty about watching it. And I thought it was super weird, and I was never really into it. And some of my first experiences with Clean Flicks were sitting in my dingy college apartment watching a really shitty version of Saving Private Ryan, And
traffic, right? Like, I remember you mentioning that one.
Yeah, traffic is, you know, which is still one of my, it's a favorite film of mine, and the Clean Flicks version was pretty terrible. So I was kind of coming at it from a standpoint of like, oh, you know, Clean Flicks is terrible, they're ruining these films, and I want to make a film that sort of shows like the process of how that is accomplished and why there's a market for it. I think, like Josh, my opinions evolved over the course of shooting the film, and I was a little bit more against it at the beginning and a little bit more understanding by the end. And I hopefully that comes across in the film, that it's not didactic or doesn't like just rip Clean Flicks apart. Hopefully there's a little bit of a nuanced discussion happening in the film about it.
I really don't know very much at all about Mormonism other than the Book of Mormon and the South Park episode. Can you tell me a little bit more about the whole idea of the prophet, or is it Taft Benson?
I mean, from the time of the founding of the church, Mormonism is a restoration religion. So the idea being that, like, Jesus was on the earth, and then everything that he did basically died with him and the apostles. And so the Catholic Church would be this great evil organization. And I'm overly simplifying this, but basically the idea is that with the founding of the Mormon Church, all of these ideas are all this original, like, authority, I guess, to, like, have Christ's church on the earth was restored with Mormonism's first prophet, who was Joseph Smith. And then so the idea of the Mormon Church is there's a living prophet that's still communicating with God, and they are Christ's original church, essentially. And so these teachings, you know, and the guidance that these guys are giving is coming directly from God. And that's the basic idea of what the church kind of is, what sets the church apart from other, like, Christian, I guess, denominations, is that they, you know, they believe that they've restored the truths of Christ's church or whatever on the earth. And so that could be everything from a major revelation regarding, you know, ways in which you should live your life, to smaller ways which you should live your life, like avoiding R-rated movies, or some Mormons think they shouldn't drink caffeinated beverages, or, you know, like things like that. You know, there, and so it kind of becomes this micromanaging kind of culture and self-censoring kind of culture, where everyone's kind of trying to play it as safely as possible and looking to their leadership for clarification on kind of everything that transpires in their lives.
Is there always a prophet in place?
Yeah. So, you know, the beginning of the film opens with Ezra Taft Benson, who was the prophet at the time in 1986, which is where when the clip took place. And once that prophet dies, then a new prophet is selected from the quorum of the 12 apostles, which are all essentially sort of like little mini prophets in training. They basically all run the church together and, like, handle all the affairs of doctrine and, like, speaking to the church membership about how to live your life and how to coexist with the world. And it's a sort of very, there's a world out there and we have to be part of it, but we have to be very careful about how we engage with it. The idea of Clean Flicks and edited films is sort of an extension of that, where people are trying to engage with the outside world, but are trying to also protect themselves and their families. And that's sort of the mentality. There's a big to-do about the speech that President Benson gave in 86 about R-rated films. And that's sort of where this idea came from. Don't watch R-rated films, protect your family from media that might corrupt you, etc.
So that clip with Benson is kind of the only thing in the film that directly relates back to the church. Mostly the film deals with just kind of American and particularly Utah Mormon culture and how that kind of relates to this industry that grew from that talk by Ezra Taft Benson. But there are definitely larger, I think, religious implications in the film that one could read into it if they wanted to.
Yeah, I love the kind of man on the street interviews, the stuff that you're shooting at BYU.
Right.
Just so many different opinions, just even amongst one community.
It's true.
Yeah, it's true, yeah. I mean, and Mormons are, I think, in a lot of ways, just as diverse as any other group of Americans. Other than the fact that they're guided by a very specific, you know, larger worldview. And I think, I don't know, it seems like it's kind of unique in a lot of ways. I mean, I guess probably, you know, the kind of Baptist culture is probably somewhat similar to it, or born again kind of Christian cultures. But I think even compared to, like, Catholic or Jewish, you know, groups within the United States, I think Mormons do kind of share a very specific larger worldview.
So what was your approach when it came to actually telling the story of Clean Flicks? Did you come at it more chronologically, or how did you want to kind of go about exploding this onto the big screen?
It really changed a lot.
It did. It went through several metamorphoses. The film was a lot different at the beginning when we were shooting. It was sort of like an investigative piece, because when we first started shooting, a lot of these stores were reopening illegally after the lawsuit had happened. We started shooting after the lawsuit. And so we were trying to uncover these stores and figure out where they were and who was supplying these edited versions of these films to them. And we were trying to sort of figure out this web of underground pirated clean films and trying to sort of figure out how it was all working. And then it evolved into a story about Daniel as well. And so it became a challenge about how to sort of blend those two things together. We felt like Daniel was such a great character, and he represented so much metaphorically about Clean Flicks that it was sort of too perfect not to include in the film. But we also felt like we needed to really dive into the whole question of editing films and what that means. And so for me, it was always a challenge about how to balance that. And, you know, the film does sort of have a two-act structure, and that's interesting to me, but I know for some people it is difficult.
I almost think it's three, because even the stores reopening illegally, that kind of plays as a twist in the film to some degree. And I think it's because when we initially started out, at least in my mind, it was just going to be the story of, and this debate of, is it okay or is it not okay to edit movies? And I still think when people review the film, they get really hung up on that, as though that should be the main focus of the film. And to me, that's like an interesting starting point that kind of gets us into this world. But to me, it's not an issue movie as much as it is this exploration of this community and this culture and this guy, and all of these things kind of play off one another. I don't think you could tell the Clean Flicks story without Daniel. I think it would be disingenuous. And I don't think you could tell Daniel's story without understanding Clean Flicks and Mormonism. And I don't think you can understand Clean Flicks without understanding Mormonism. So I think they all kind of, there's an interplay between all those different elements. And I think initially I just imagined the film would be a lot of it be this debate, which is kind of the first third of the film about should there or shouldn't there be edited movies. And I think some people do kind of want more of that from the film, but that when, as things developed, that became kind of the least interesting question for me personally.
It is an interesting question, though. The more I've seen the film, the more I do wonder, I see when I rent whatever, Grandma's Boy or whatever it is, there's always the theatrical version and then the unrated version, but there's not like the hyper edited version of that.
Right.
And it seems like maybe they could go, swing that pendulum the other way. Did you guys ever get an answer as far as why there aren't TV or airplane versions of these available?
It was really hard for us to get anything from the DGA or from any of the directors. We got some limited response from a few of the directors we approached. Martin Scorsese, I think, responded, and
James Cameron.
They were too busy, but were interested in the film or something, but were too busy just to do an interview. And we requested a DGA, and I can't remember what they said, but something about the issue being dead for them, and they're not interested in participating. So
I think they just didn't want to bring it up again, because in their minds they kind of publicly won the debate. And so to bring it up again for them is just kind of a no-win situation, I think, in some ways. We also interviewed Spielberg's producer, who is a Mormon. The guy who produced Schindler's List and Jurassic Park is a Mormon. And we did get an interview with him, kind of hoping it would lead us to Spielberg, but that didn't really work out. And so we were very limited in that way, and kind of stuck with a lot of the official press releases and news interviews they'd done in the past. But their stance basically officially was there's not a market for it,
right,
which I kind of don't buy. I mean, I feel like it's pretty clear that there would be a pretty large market in the United States for something like that. But
yeah, I agree. And I think one of the reasons we probably didn't dive into this larger question of to edit or not to edit, or who, is it okay to repurpose this material? And we dove into that, I think, sufficiently, but I think we didn't dive into it further than we did, because a lot of the arguments we were making in our minds, pro and con, in terms of whether you should re-edit this content or not, was stuff that we were intellectually creating that wasn't being said by any of our subjects or any people defending Clean Flicks or arguing against Clean Flicks. The arguments that were presented in the media and between Clean Flicks and between Hollywood, in quotes, wasn't super intellectual. It was very simple. And so right. It felt like to me that if we were to over-intellectualize and go too deep with this argument, that it wouldn't represent the dialogue that was happening. And so we tried to sort of stick with what those people were saying and tried not to interject our arguments into the film as much.
It's a good point because, I mean, I think I have my own kind of way that I think clean flicks, the idea of a clean flicks type thing makes sense to me theoretically. But as Andrew said, it's not really the argument these guys were using. And so, you know, it's like I feel like we represented that well. And all the other things we could have thrown in the film were pretty silly examples. People saying like, well, if I buy a cheeseburger, I can take the pickles off and leave the tomato on and get some extra mayonnaise. And it's like, okay, well, it's not really worth spending time with in the film, you know?
Here's your soapbox. What are some of the things that you would have said had you editorialized in the film?
That's a good question.
I mean, I think some of the stuff Phil Gordon says, who is the professor in the film, a lot of his ideas are purely his ideas, but it was also a way for to get a few of the ideas in that I was kind of interested in discussing. And one of those is just the idea of the end user. I mean, I feel like we're in this digital age we're in. I'm in favor of the end user personally. And, you know, the example I would always give when we were discussing it was on Seinfeld, when Jerry goes to see Schindler's List and he makes out during Schindler's List. You know, Steven Spielberg can't control how you're going to view his film, even if it's unedited. You can't really control someone's viewing experience. You can't. And again, as we get into the digital age, you've got people mashing up and mixing up every kind of content that they want. And I'm kind of in favor of that because I kind of subscribe to this idea of the death of the artist. I think once your art is out in the world, it's kind of up to the viewers to kind of take that art and make of it what they will and receive it the way they will receive it. And, you know, and it's not really, the artist really doesn't, even if we want to believe that it's correct that the artists have control over that, which I think a lot of us who are artists want to be artists or love art do feel that way, that the artist's point of view is the most important. The truth of the matter, in my opinion, is that really there's no way to control that. It's kind of out of the artist's hands. And so I think to deny that, and especially again in the digital age, is just foolish. I mean, I don't think that there's really a way we're going to be able to put a cap on that. The genie is kind of out of the bottle in that way. And so I think Clean Flicks is ahead of its time in a way. It was just saying, look, we're making content that the users want. And if the studios want to stay in business and they were smart, they would adapt to what their users want. And I think that is part of the fear of the studios is that, and this is what the Hollywood Reporter guy that we talked to in Toronto when we premiered the film related to us, is he thought it was about control of the product. They don't want 30 different versions out there on the shelves. They want to have control over the product and control over who sees what. And the film, you know, there are two different arguments happening. There was the filmmakers who it was about the art, and then there was the studios, it was about the copyright. It was about money. And they were different arguments, you know,
they were kind of
melded together into that one argument.
The thing was is that Clean Flicks, maybe it's because it was too soon and that wasn't really part of like the national sort of consciousness yet, but that wasn't an argument that Clean Flicks was really making.
Right.
They were doing it to make money, and they weren't doing it in the name of like the rights of at the end user. I mean, to a degree, but it really wasn't about that. It was mostly about the money and about like a moral crusade. And if they had made the argument that like, hey, look,
and censorship. I mean, there was that's where my problem with it comes in, is the censorship aspect of it.
Yeah, exactly. If they had made the argument that, you know, we're doing this because we're taking a stand against like corporate control of our media, then I would have had a much easier time with it. But that was never an argument that they made.
Yeah, as I was watching this, I kept thinking about the fan editing phenomenon and just how that's somewhat different, but also the same idea of the users taking control of what they're seeing and what the end product is.
I had a hard time getting around that idea when we were making the film, and I felt like I was pushing really hard, like, we've got to say this in the movie. And I realized finally, you know, through a lot of conversation with Andrew and with Phil, the professor, that the censorship, you know, aspect of that is really what makes it different. Because I kept thinking to myself, well, what is the difference between the Phantom Edit, which everybody loves, and the Clean Flicks edit, which everybody hates. You know, like, why is that one, you know, okay with us as an audience and this one's not? And I really do think that that's where the line for me is drawn.
You know, they take the version that they made and they sell it and they duplicate it and make a bunch of money off of it.
Yeah,
and,
not to mention all the piracy right. that's going on and all that stuff, right. which is a totally different thing.
Right.
Yeah, which is really interesting when you guys talk about the whole idea of the one-to-one
argument.
It's your product, yeah, and then how many copies were being made.
The day that it really struck me, we were in the back room of Daniel's office, and I'm standing there, and there's a stack, like a full DVD spool of just Beverly Hills Cop 3, and I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, there's no way he bought 300 copies of Beverly Hills Cop 3. Like, what am I looking at here, you know? And then I realized, you know, he's clearly just, you know, duping these, like, and making a fortune, you know, off of – he's selling these for $20, $25 a piece, you know, and then burning them in the back room.
Yeah. I mean, unofficially, sort of, because there's no way to verify, we sort of did the math one time and tried to figure out what his overhead costs were, how much money he was making, and there was a little bit of guesswork there, so this isn't, like, completely accurate, but I think we estimated, if I remember correctly, Josh, that he was making six figures.
Oh, yeah.
Doing this.
Yeah, so,
wow. One thing that I love that your film does is the whole idea of showing what the difference is between these clean versions and the dirty versions, dirty in quotes. I noticed that the quality seems to drop when you do the edited versions. Is that just kind of to show us that there's a difference? Or
those were actually what the quality was on those discs. Those are pulled from
yeah.
those discs.
Exactly. So. We
and like
those
the Saving Private
the
Ryan,
quality.
For instance, like the Saving Private Ryan, they never did a digital edit of that movie. That was a leftover from the VHS edit they did, and then they just printed that to a disc. So, like, there's some really low quality versions out there floating around.
Yep, yep.
What's probably one of the worst ones that you saw? I know you mentioned Traffic and Saving Private Ryan. Any others kind of stick out in your guys' minds?
Pulp Fiction was pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, there's two different things. There are the ones that are just unwatchable because of all the choppiness of it, and because, you know, because of there's so much profanity or whatever in a certain scene. Then the other one is where you just completely lose understanding of what's actually going on in the movie, where you completely lose the context, because it's not like they're more, you know, conservative than even a television edit in a lot of ways. They'll cut an entire scene and you don't know what happened, you know. Like, I think that Weatherman shows that pretty well, the clip that we use in the film, but also even the Big Lebowski scene is just like, what is that scene even about? Like, they might as well have cut that whole scene because it doesn't make any sense
right.
in the form that it is in the film.
Right. Memento, which is already a difficult film to follow. Right. Like it's terrible. Like, it's crazy. Like, there's entire plot points completely missing from the Clean Flicks yeah. version that are important to understand to lead to the big reveal at the end of the film.
Oh, and I've got my answer, by the way. I remembered. It's Mulholland Drive is absolutely the worst I've seen. There's no way to understand Mulholland Drive with an edited version, let alone, I mean, it's already difficult again, the normal version, to even have a grasp on what you're watching, but the edited version's unbearable.
It seems like some of the decisions as to what movies that they're going to cut just seem kind of wrongheaded.
I would actually disagree with you there, because I think that is a common reaction. People are like, well, why did they edit Cars? That doesn't make any sense. But it actually, like, I would say it does make sense. And I'm actually understanding this more as I'm a parent, too. I've become a parent since we started shooting the film. And I do understand, like, if you're going to cut a swear word out of Pulp Fiction, you're definitely going to want to cut it out of the version of Cars, you know, like, and the swear word to them would be a reference to deity, you know, oh my God, or damn, or hell, any of those things get cut out. And it actually makes sense that they trim that out of Holes. That's actually a film that's intended for that audience, and they want to kind of, like, be careful with, you know, the way those are presented. I mean, I would say on the other end of the spectrum, why even bother editing Hostel? You know, that's a film that I saw for the first time edited, and it was still quite disturbing to me. It's like not my favorite type of movie, and it's like, wow, okay, like, this was intense watch for me as an edited film. I don't know who is, like, walking away from that and feeling like that was an uplifting spiritual experience having watched, you know, the edited version of Hostel, which just, you know, cuts out the screwdriver going into the hand or whatever, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing, too, that gets me is the whole idea of the removal of sex and sexuality, but the leaving in of violence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's an American thing to some degree.
It is.
It's just amplified, I think, in this very sort of conservative Mormon culture. It's definitely an American thing, and I found it to be a little bit amplified especially in the Clean Flicks universe.
Yeah.
Where, now that is interesting. People are desensitized to violence and overly sensitive to sex. And it plays out in pretty disturbing ways sometimes. And that's one of the reasons we were interested in Daniel as a character.
I actually really like the section of the film. And I can say this because Andrew cut this scene, but I like when Robert is talking about that exact idea. You know, we cut out all the, you know, the one little bad scene and leave in all the action and the cool stuff. And I like the choice that Andrew made of Braveheart in that moment, because it's like that violence is pretty horrific. Like this old man getting his arm chopped up compared to like some, you know, like a silhouetted shot of two people in love, you know, like it's just funny that that's what choice was made in that film.
Do you think seeing all those R-rated movies is what affected Daniel Thompson's morality?
No.
I wish.
But I do think there's something to be said about the business that you're in, where you're constantly trying to hide something about yourself or hide something from a community that plays into this sort of need to fit in. And Daniel, it was already, I think, a bit of an outcast in the Mormon community and was putting on airs, pretending to be somebody he wasn't. And I think that there is an interesting connection there between his business, the way he ran his business, and who he was as a person.
And it forced him to live a double life. Like, just business forced him to live a double life, you know? One thing I was talking to someone about the other day is, you know, we'd go into Daniel's office and there'd be, you know, a cup of coffee or there was a case of wine or a Playboy. And in anywhere else in the country, that's not like a warning sign of any kind. But in a Clean Flicks office and within what those things all mean in Mormon culture, that would should have been like a huge sign to us that like this guy's not who he says he is, you know, because again, even coffee is maybe like considered taboo in Mormon culture. And so, you know, this guy, he really was living a double life. And I think it may have promoted all these other things that happened in his life because there were so many lies to keep up with. And everything he did was kind of false on a day-to-day basis. All of his interactions had this underlying, I mean, although I, you know, I will say in Daniel's defense, like he's a very like genuine, let me see, how do I put this? He's a very kind person and he's a very self-sacrificing person. Like he's the give you the shirt off your back kind of guy. And I do believe that he really did like, you know, the people that were coming into his store. I think those relationships were probably real in the sense that he really liked them and probably cared about them, but they were, and also in the sense that we had a real relationship with him. But the truth of the matter is that he lied to us completely every time that we talked to him. There was an underlying lie to every interaction we ever had with him. And I think the same goes with all of his customers. There was a lie happening at all times on his end. And so I think it's just hard, you know, to start distinguishing when am I telling,
right,
you know, when is this good and when is this bad, basically.
I feel like our relationship with him was based on like in this conception that we had about him that was perpetuated by his need to present himself in a certain light. And we're like, oh, Daniel's so nice, he's so helpful, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there was always like an ulterior motive or something else going on. And eventually we clued into that and began to think a little bit differently about how to approach interviews with him, how to incorporate him into the film. And really it was in the editing process that we discovered that Daniel was really a great way to deconstruct Clean Flicks by using him as like a metaphor in a way. Not that, you know, editing these films is going to lead you to this behavior, but that when you try to hide something about yourself and when you try to pretend to be something that you're not, that's never a good situation. And so, yeah. I think really Daniel is a metaphor for clean films or for re-edited films, because when you take something away from yourself and hide something that's about who you are, inevitably it's all going to come crashing down. And I think that so in that sense, he works as a way to deconstruct and critique Clean Flicks without having to like say it explicitly.
Yeah, and I think people sometimes are upset that like, well, Daniel's not a good example of what the average Clean Flicks store owner is, and I think that is true. Like, but I think he is the best possible person to include in the film because of what Andrew just said. And I think, and also not to mention the fact that, again, I think it would be completely dishonest of us to have made a Clean Flicks movie and not mention Daniel. Like, that would have been insane, actually. You know, we would have come under much stronger fire for not including Daniel in the story, I think.
Josh, I just want to back up for a second. Did you say that Daniel was an outcast in his own community?
it's revealed later that his personal values don't line up with the community values.
Okay. But when you first found him, he was pretty much...
That was always the case. We just didn't know that at first, right? And so, I mean, one thing that was cut from the film that I think maybe in the deleted scenes is that Daniel left the church kind of officially when he was in his teens. And kind of in a funny way, it was over Dungeons & Dragons because he was a Dungeons & Dragons fan. And, you know, he was playing with all his friends. And then one of the kids' moms decided it was evil and that Daniel was evil for introducing it to their children. And so he kind of became a social outcast in his neighborhood because of that. And it's weird. Like, it kind of led to him and down this life of all of this deviant behavior because so much of his life was lived in secret, you know, and because so much of his life had this false artifice in front of it, you know, and it's really sad in some ways. I think it's pretty tragic.
I know there's got to be more stories that are out there that didn't make the final cut. What were some of the other things you found out about him?
I mean, a lot.
I'm not going to go there.
Okay. We put the stuff in that we felt like directly related to either the Clean Flick store or our story, you know. So there is some stuff with his ex-girlfriend that seems maybe like it crosses that line into not explicitly dealing with the store, but it had to do with him working in that area and some of his other business practices. There's a lot of other stuff we heard about his personal life that was alleged that I'm not sure if it was true or not, but it was much, much worse than what we put in the film.
Yeah. Exactly. To put it like in its simplest terms, we could have made Daniel look terrible.
We were ultimately kind to him in the cut of the film right now. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Just even that one line about, you know, having sex from behind that the woman says, I'm just like, it's just is a strange.
That's a funny line. That took us off guard as well. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there were a lot of allegations. I don't know. Probably guess shouldn't say anything. Andrew or what?
Start to finish, how long did Clean Flicks take to make?
So we started in, what, October-ish of 2006, and then it premiered in September of 2009 in Toronto. So that's three years of production. And then, you know, we spent another couple of years going to festivals and trying to figure out distribution. So
figure out how to get the film out there.
Yeah, man. Like 5 years. You want, or 6 years, years?
5 to 6 before it actually came out on DVD. I mean, it came out on DVD and stuff in 2012, so quite a long haul. I mean, I guess I had this romantic notion in my head of growing up with, you know, Kevin Smith and Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez and all those guys, like, being in the forefront of independent film as I was, like, coming of age. Like, oh, well, you get your film into a major film festival, and then you have a huge film career, and that's, like, how it goes, you know? And we had kind of a rude awakening, I think, when our film didn't sell at Toronto, and we had to figure out, oh, okay, so now what do you do? And we were a little naive, I think. And so it was a big learning curve and a big learning process. I feel in some ways I'm really grateful for it because I feel like I learned so much that I'm going to really benefit from having had that experience on Clean Flicks. And the landscape had changed so much. I mean, the film industry really crashed 2009. So we kind of came at the exact wrong time. But, and you know, so in some ways that made it really difficult. But, you know, now people don't know that end of the story. Now it's, well, it's on Netflix and it's on iTunes and Amazon. So we kind of could skip over that part of the story and just pretend we were huge successes right off the bat. But you know, the truth is that we really had to fight and claw for it for quite a long time. And I learned so much. I'm so, so thankful for that experience.
While you were clawing and fighting, what was the general reaction to the film?
Generally positive. A lot of mixed feelings about it. You know, some people really were keen on the Daniel story and weren't interested in the sort of Clean Flicks arguments and vice versa. People felt like Daniel was an addition to the film and wasn't necessary. But I think generally the consensus was it's entertaining, it's funny, it's interesting, it's illuminating a universe I didn't really know about. And for some people who don't know anything about Mormon, anything about this sort of cottage underground clean film industry, it was kind of a mind fuck for some people. We had a lot of really fun, intense screenings. I mean, even at our premiere at TIFF, there was hooping and hollering and laughing. And I mean, the reactions to the film have been very visceral.
It's weird because, like, for us, it's really easy to cue in on all the criticisms. And we've brought up a lot of them already in this interview because those are the kind of things that, like, stick in our craw and, like, we want to respond to. Especially on the online reception of, like, online critics and movie blogs and stuff like that, like, it's been overwhelmingly good reviews. I mean, I think we've maybe had actually, like, two bad reviews, and then maybe four mixed reviews, and everything else has been super, super supportive and positive. But it's like, it's really hard to get by those in your mind. And especially like when a site like Rotten Tomatoes only doesn't count like Ain't It Cool News or Slash Film as real critics. And so, which are, you know, pretty big movie sites. It's really frustrating when like two of your bad reviews have been in quote unquote, like real critic, because he's from some, you know, podunk newspaper in the middle of nowhere, but his review is the one that everyone reads when they go to Rotten Tomatoes. So that stuff like drives me nuts, because like I think if it was actually like a score on Rotten Tomatoes was reflected by the breadth of reviews we've had on the film, it would be like in the 90s. But you know, it's not, because we only had reviews from two, you know, four real critics, and two of them were negative, so whatever. So that's frustrating. But everybody at festival seems to like it. You know, Mormons, I kind of alluded to, seem to be annoyed, or conservatives in general, even if they're not Mormons, seem to be annoyed that like Daniel doesn't represent the clean movie industry, and we shouldn't have included him in that way. And that bothers me, because I guess I disagree with that statement. And I think on the other end, people really wanted a slam dunk case against clean flicks. Like, we should have just really spent all of our time on the stuff we covered in the first act and just like put a nail in their coffin and, you know, and been done with it. And that also wasn't really what we were interested in. We were kind of trying to create this nuanced film that would allow the viewer to kind of have those discussions with their friends and family, and, you know, and kind of discover, you know, their own feelings about it for themselves. Because I actually left with, you know, a pretty, I don't feel like very strongly one way or the other on the issue. I kind of see all sides.
Is the clean flicks industry dead, or has it just kind of taken a different path?
Online, I think there are remnants of it still around. It's really hard to know. I mean, we talked to some of the guys who are main editors for clean flicks, and the last time we talked to them, like, they had some like millionaire that had created like a FTP site that they were editing movies for, and people could just like subscribe to download movies. And somebody sent us on Twitter recently a photograph of like a Redbox style machine in Idaho that rents edited movies at their local grocery store. And apparently they're all over certain parts of Idaho. Some company is doing that right now. So I don't know. Mostly, I guess they're still out there. The brick and mortar stores are, for all intents and purposes, dead.
That goes for everybody,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, exactly.
I got a feeling that you could be feeling a whole lot better than you feel today. You say you got a problem? Well, that's no problem. It's super easy not to feel that way. When you start to get confused because of thoughts in your head, don't feel those feelings. Hold them in instead. Turn it off like a light switch. Just go click. It's a cool little Mormon trick. We do it all the time when you're feeling certain feelings that just don't seem right. Treat those pesky feelings like a reading light and turn them off like a light switch. Just go bap. Really, what's so hard about that? Turn it off! Turn it off!
Thanks to Josh and Andrew for coming by and talking about Clean Flicks. Of course, you can find out more about them and the film and other things that they're working on over at our website, projection-booth.com. Now, Mike, you know, Clean Flicks is kind of a, I don't want to say it's a meta documentary, but it's a film about a film, or it's a film about, you know, film rating or film censorship. And, you know, as we've talked about before on the podcast, I mean, we're big fans of things such as Real Engine and, you know, The Celluloid Closet and things like that, things that sort of take a look at film history in some way and give it to you in a documentary form and really give you some things to think about. And one of which that's sort of in line with Clean Flicks that I think is worth the time is This Film Is Not Yet Rated.
Yeah, I caught that one a few years ago. I'd heard about it, and I don't know what it was, but it took me a long time to check it out. And luckily, that was over on Netflix streaming, as is Clean Flicks, which makes it pretty easy for folks to go and check out. And yeah, This Film Is Not Yet Rated was Kirby Dick kind of taking a look at the ratings industry and seeing exactly why things are the way they are, or at least trying to get to the bottom of it, because it always seemed like there was such a double, triple, quadruple standard when it came to why things got the ratings that they got. And it seems like, I don't know, my conclusion that I kind of walked away from with that was that really so much of it seems to go with how much money that you have.
Yeah, the thing I like about This Film Is Not Yet Rated is how he'll compare possibly two films that have similar scenes or similar themes and say, okay, this one got this rating and this one got that rating. And it's almost exactly the same in terms of what was there. And the difference is that, okay, maybe like this one's backed by the major studio and this one's an independent film. So the independent film ends up with a worse rating and it makes it harder for it to get into theaters or to get advertising or things like that. I remember when reading stories, I mean, obviously I wasn't around then, but I remember reading stories about when Midnight Cowboy came out and Clockwork Orange and its original rating, those things were rated X. And there were newspapers that would not take the ads. They would list in the theater, call theater for title. They wouldn't even put the title in the listings within the newspaper because certain places in the country had those kind of rules. And then also when you end up with a unrated or specifically an X-rated film in certain places, you can't even show it. For example, when I worked at the Main Art Theater, we were doing Midnights and we were showing the first 3D porn film. They had re-released it. It's called, if you ever wanted to know what it is, it's Disco Dolls and Hot Skin in 3D. That's the title. And John Holmes is in it and stuff like that. I think Harry Reams might be in it as well. And there were two versions that went out for Midnights. There was a hot version and there was a cold version, sort of like when we talked about with Misty Beethoven. And we wanted to show the full hardcore version. But the problem was that because it was considered an X-rated film and the city of Royal Oak had a statute about X-rated film in Royal Oak, because we were too close to the church, we couldn't show it. It needed to be 1,000 feet from a church or a school or something like that, and we were only like 500 feet, so we couldn't show it. So all the employees got to see at night after hours, the theater was closed, the full version, and then the next weekend or whatever, the next day, they had to show the edited version because otherwise they could have got fined, they could have got shut down. So there's all these rules when it comes to the ratings. I mean, the ratings kind of matter. I mean, and I think they mattered more in the past. I don't know if they matter as much anymore. But they were definitely, when theaters were the major way of getting your money for a film, it was an important thing.
Well, yeah, I think for both of us, you know, the farther north we get of 18, the less and less that they matter. And since neither one of us have kids, we're not really that concerned about stuff. I mean, there are times where it's like, what's this film rated? Like, as I'm watching something and there's something really super objectionable in it, it's like, what? You know, I'm like, oh, okay, it was PG-13, or oh, all right, that was rated R. I didn't realize that that's what it was. And I'll hear things, you know, when it comes to movies that are being released where it's like, oh, well, you know, this is an R-rated comedy and this one's a PG, or, you know, the controversy there was a few years ago about, I think it was Hatchet 2 and all this. And it's just like, you know, and when you're telling the story about Disco Dolls and Hot Skin, I mean, we're not talking like 1975. I mean, we're talking 90s, right?
No, we're talking 99, 2000. So wow. Not that long ago. And the thing that was funny is just last week on Hackers, I brought up the fact that, you know, I'm watching Hackers and I'm saying to myself, I'm like, what is this thing rated? And I looked at it, I was like, PG-13. I'm like, really? I'm like, so in 1995, you could get away with fetish sex references and still get a PG-13 rating. I thought that was pretty amazing.
Well, yeah. I mean, before we, you know, started talking this evening, just talking about the differences between what a PG movie was in the 70s versus what it is today and how different it is. You know, you go back and you look at some of these movies and you're like, this was rated PG in 1975. Okay. You know, like, I don't think Jaws would get a PG these days. I think that would get an R just because of all the gore that's in there, like the head floating and all this kind of stuff, you know, the blood and the water and everything. Yeah, you don't see a lot, but there's so much that's implied that I think that Spielberg would have a hard time on his hands.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing that's so fascinating about This Film Is Not Yet Rated. And one of the things that I really found interesting about the film is that when we talk about kind of in a way with Clean Flicks, too, I mean, there's kind of a corollary here where at least with Clean Flicks, you're like, OK, that guy owns the company. But when it came to the ratings board, you know, Kirby Dick's trying to find out who's on the ratings board, and they're all anonymous. There's no list of who these people are. He goes, some people that he was able to track down said, oh, well, you know, there's like some parents, and then there's, you know, people from this group and that group. But there's no accountability. That's the problem, is because since there is nobody there to actually, you know, lodge a complaint with and go, what are you talking about? Like, you know, it's not like they're congresspeople or senators or something like that, and they're making these decisions. Now, at the same time, one can say it is an industry-created rating system, which means that originally the rating system was created in order to pull films away from the Hays Code. Now, we really have to go back and explain the Hays Code. See, in the silent era of the 20s and into the early 30s, what we call pre-code Hollywood – basically, they could do kind of whatever they wanted. And then Will Hays, who was the Postmaster General, was somehow hired or elected or something to be basically the film censor of America. So if you wanted to make a film, you gave him the script. He looked at it and said, okay, this is objectionable, that's objectionable, whatever. And then that's the reason why movies within that period, when we talk about like the late 30s through to the 1960s, there's a lot of stuff buried in the subtext. And it almost like when we'll talk about coming up in a few weeks, sort of like working under communism and working, you know, making films in the Eastern Bloc under Soviet control. There's so much stuff that found its way in there that after, you know, the ratings board didn't understand what was in the script, you know, and people go, wow, that's amazing. I mean, like, look at it. Like, they had so much stuff, so many restraints on them that they were able to make this stuff. So eventually what happened is by the time you get to the mid-60s, they realize that this sort of like censorship board isn't working. And the better way to go about it is to just let the studios make the movies they want to make and then put them before this ratings board that would be sort of paid for and controlled by the studios in some way. And they would come up with this rating system, and then that would be easier than going, okay, we need to read every single script and go over every single line and make sure that, you know, this objectionable content is not in there. So it was sort of an evolutionary step. So the question then becomes, have we also moved beyond the concept of the ratings board now? You know, do you still think that it's viable? Do you still think that it's something that we should have, or is it something that's now passé and it should just go away?
Yeah, I'm not sure if what should happen. I mean, you know, we've gone through so many stages here in the U.S. with this kind of stuff, and it kind of makes me wonder, how are other countries handling it? You know, I've seen good and bad when it comes to other places. I mean, like, there are so many strict I hate to say the strict restrictions when it comes to like the UK, you know, seeing like, oh, well, 5 seconds of violence were trimmed so this could get their strongest rating and that kind of stuff. So I don't know if anybody's really gotten it right yet. And I don't know if just going to a, you know, voluntary rating system, it might be for the best. I mean, there are times where filmmakers will actually put in worse stuff to get that harder rating because of the demographics that they want to reach. I mean, I was proofreading Graydon Clark's autobiography over the weekend, and he was talking about Wacko was released in the U.S. as a PG, and then they wanted to re-release it as an R. And so he put it in front of the ratings board again and said, you know, this time I need to get an R. And they said, no, this is still a PG. And he's like, well, what can I do to put this in? And they're like, you know, what can I do to make it harder? And they're like, yeah, we can't really tell you. And he's like, well, how about if I put in every teenager that fucks has to die? And they're like, yeah, that would do it. Why can't he just say, make this R-rated instead of, you know, like having to do all these kind of things? Or like talking to, you know, we'll hear from William Friedkin in a few weeks here, where he was talking about how he shot and put in tons and tons of stuff in Cruising because he knew there was going to be objectionable stuff. And that's how he got what he wanted in there through past the ratings board. It's like this big freaking game that people are playing. So why can't we at least try like an honor system rating kind of thing and, you know, maybe go from there?
Yeah, I remember a similar thing with the South Park guys when they did the South Park film, I believe it was, or if it was Team America, it was one or the other. Could have been both, where they said they would put worst things in there, like worst jokes, but stuff that they knew that they were willing to cut. And then that way, when the board said, oh, you need to cut this stuff, they would trim that out, and then they would get through what they really wanted. So it was a way of loading it with a bunch of crap that they that was never going to make it to the screen anyway. And it's just kind of ridiculous. I mean, I do agree. When Roger Ebert was alive, he was talking about NC-17 or X, and he said that NC-17 and X is sort of a kiss of death, especially when we were talking about on the VHS show with things like Blockbuster not being willing to carry it. So he had come up with the idea of adult rating. And the idea would be that, for example, like Requiem for a Dream, that it could be rated adult. That meant that it was an adult drama. It was not a sex film, you know, or something like that. That it was, that it had all these merits, but it was an intense thing. And it was not under any stretch of the imagination for anyone who is not, you know, of age who could handle something like that.
I do have to say, I'm surprised that the South Park guys weren't in Clean Flicks. I don't know if they tried to get those guys or what happened there, because they just seem like such poster children for being in that kind of area. You know, they're not in Utah, they're over in Colorado, but just like the attention that they've paid to Mormons over the years and just how they like to point out some of those inconsistencies is pretty good.
As I was going to say, you know, I'm here in Colorado, so I can see Utah from my back door. Oh, wait, I shouldn't say back door. I meant from my door, I guess.
Your rear porch?
Yeah, back door is probably would get censored by the Clean Flicks guys.
All right, we'll be back after a preview from next week's show.
People like to laugh at sex. People like to laugh at dirty things. And people love to be shocked, I think.
Kill everyone now.
So that's my job, to get out there and shock them.
Get those cameras rolling!
Divine, it was dangerous. Part outlaw, part serial killer.
Who wants to die for art? I do!
Divine was a cinematic terrorist.
I didn't get my reputation for nothing, you know.
She was just barreling through the screens, chewing up the scenery, and owning every minute of it.
Why, you sneaking, conniving little abortion!
She was simultaneously sexy and monstrous and terrifying. Is she gonna screw me or eat me?
You wanna fuck me?
He had something that no one else has.
She just had this power.
She was a midnight movie star. You could only see her after midnight, but it was worth staying up.
People would say, you can't do that. Well, why not?
Well, fuck you all very much.
He was such a good soul and such a funny person that even the absurd and horrific things he did are forgiven. He could get away with them.
How's this for a center spread?
He was breaking the rules of drag and defying them by wearing stuff that a fat person would never, ever wear. He took it to a different level. He took it to a level of anarchy.
Do not forget, I am Divine!
All right, we'll be back looking at the brand spanking new documentary, I Am Divine. Not me personally, but anyway. Jeffrey Schwartz will be our special guest, and the film traces the life and times of Glenn Milstead. Now, if you never heard that name before, I'm sure you know who he is. That's right, better known as Divine.
Yeah, we'll be back next week with going from the cleanest of the clean to the filthiest of the filthy. So please feel free to go on by our website, projection-booth.com. Leave us some feedback if you want, or, you know, head on over to iTunes, leave us some stars. We prefer 5, and you can give us a nice review. I mean, giving you all this free entertainment, why not pay it back with a little bit of that? You know, it's kind of like Pay It Forward, which is a movie that I'm sure would not be objectionable to our Mormon friends.
Oh, sure.
Screen is seeking blood. My
so safe in the safety of your room.
All I want is to make a killing, to drill and kill and have me really thrilling. Why am I facing so unwilling? You can be sure that you won't see me.
Careful with that axe, you meanie.
Go, Larry. You see what happens? You see what happens, Larry? This is what happens, Larry. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps? This is what happens. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens, Larry? This is what happens when you feed a slaughtered scrambled eggs. Ah! What happens, Larry?
Baby!
This is what happens when you fool a stranger.
What the hell are you doing, man?